I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier this month, the New England governors and Eastern Canadian premiers met in Stowe for the 42nd annual conference bringing these regional leaders or their representatives together. They discussed trade, tourism, transportation, and power, specifically a regional approach to affordable and renewable energy. Here's Quebec Premier Philippe Couillard touting the qualities of hydropower, specifically the large-scale hydropower exported to the U.S. from his province, to meet the growing energy needs across New England and eastern Canada.
The environment is one of the centerpieces of this agreement. Hydroelectricity is one of the greenest energy you can have. Not that we don't like wind power or solar energy, all this we have too in Quebec, but the best baseline energy, because it doesn't fluctuate depending if there's sun or there's wind or not, is hydroelectricity. It doesn't replace other renewables. It actually makes it easier to develop more renewables. And the proof was made here in Vermont. After we signed this agreement, this long-term agreement, the amount of renewable energy sources created here increased. So this is what we have to do, go away from fossil fuel sources and carbon-rich types of energies, and go forward to renewables. And hydroelectricity is something that has to be the centerpiece, again, the baseload of what we do between countries. On energy, you can almost view Quebec as the battery of northeastern North America.
But that battery is not as green as Premier Couillard makes it seem, according to some people with concerns about the sustainability and ethical practices of Hydro-Quebec. Now, every energy source comes with a cost. Carbon emissions are a big consideration, but so are other factors. Habitat continuity, production costs, waste considerations. And Vermont's definition of renewable energy is fungible. The legislature has changed the language over the years. Hydropower from Hydro-Quebec was not considered renewable a decade ago. Now it is. Today on the show, we're going to look at that question of what constitutes renewable and how we calculate how green an energy source is. I'm joined first by Paul Hines. He's an associate professor of electrical engineering at UVM and leader of the school's Energy and Complexity Group, which aims to bring different energy sources into our complex electrical systems. He's also the co-founder of a startup called Packetized Energy, which uses hardware and software to help utilities solve grid problems, especially when it comes to using more renewables. Paul Hines, welcome back to the show. Nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here, Jane. Thanks.
So Vermont does have these statutory energy goals that we are striving towards. We're in the middle of them now. We have a 50% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 2028 and a 75% reduction by 2050, and those are from 1990 levels. And then also we have some source goals. So we're working towards 25% renewable sources for our energy by 2025, 40% by 2035, and 90% by 2050. So how are we doing?
Well, Vermont is actually really seen, even outside the state, as a real leader in this space. For electricity, we're actually even further ahead than that. So the state policy for 2018 is to be above 56% renewable electricity for the electric sector. There's some real challenges in getting heating and transportation, which are two-thirds of our energy, go to those two uses, getting those into renewable sources. So that's a real challenge. But Vermont is seen as a leader, and they're really taking some very exciting steps in that in the right direction.
So if we were to summarize, we're doing pretty well on electricity, not so good on home heating and transportation.
Heating and transportation are real challenges. There's opportunities. So electric vehicles are an opportunity. So as the grid gets greener, we can move stuff over to electric vehicles, which has the opportunity to really green up that space. Home heating is starting to change too. So home air source heat pumps are now possible, and you can actually run them in cold weather. And a lot of people are finding that works really well for them. So there are opportunities, but some challenges as well.
Could we see more people going to electric heat if our electric resources become greener, or, you know, I use that word in quotes, but greener and greener,
yeah.
You know, moving more towards electric and trying to get away mm-hmm. from some of the carbon-based sources?
Yeah. So the air source heat pumps are actually an electric heating system. And so people who have made that transition are using Vermont's relatively green electricity for their heating system. So it's a real possibility.
So when we talk about renewable resources and I mean, this is important because of our statutory goals and what our mm-hmm. aims are and what we've put into law. And this question of 90% renewable sources by 2050, a lot of the question of how we get there and if we get there depends on what we're calling a renewable source. So sure. What is that definition?
Well, a renewable source in general is just a source of electricity where the fundamental resource is replenished. And so wind is replenished by the climate, solar continues to come from the sun, and hydro is replenished through the process of air, water absorbing into the air and then coming back down as rain. And so those are renewable sources. Wood can be considered renewable because forests regrow and we cut them if they're managed sustainably. It's a little tricky when you get into the details because there's competing priorities when you start to think about these things, but that's the core of renewability.
And when it comes to actually defining them, though, and you say it does get a little bit tricky, I mean, as you said, it's not as simple as saying, well, the sun is there and the sun continues to be there, therefore all solar is renewable, because a lot of it has depended on size and scale and what the mm-hmm. project is. And that's basically a political calculation.
Yeah, and I think there's a difference between renewability and good. I mean, every type of energy that we're going to use is going to have some impact. And so when you build big solar farms, there's an impact on farming. You build big wind farms, that has an impact on the view sheds up on mountaintops. And hydro plants have impacts on landscape. And so all of these things have impacts. And so when we say renewable, it doesn't mean that there's no impact. It's just it's a way for us to think about what types of impacts do we want to choose.
And we're going to broaden this discussion and bring in more voices, but that's an important point, Professor Hines, that every source comes with a cost. Every source has pros mm-hmm. and cons. And so the definition of renewable or the definition of green is not the only definition that we should be paying attention to when we consider our energy portfolio and energy goals. So how do you think about that balance?
Yeah, I think everyone agrees that we need to clean up our electricity system and all of our energy infrastructure. So the carbon emissions are causing climate change. There's really no scientific debate remaining on that. And we know we need to move away from carbon-based fuels. The question is really, how do we do that in a way that and manage those impacts? And so and that's really a challenging thing that I'm glad that people are having this debate. How do we make the right choices that balance the land uses and help people to help us to get to that clean energy future that we really all want?
All right. Let's bring in more voices. Steve Crowley is a retired science teacher and environmental advocate with the Vermont chapter of the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club has concerns about how Vermont classifies renewable energy. Steve joins us now in the studio. Nice to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
And in our Montpelier studio is Tony Klein, a former representative in the Vermont House and past chair of the House Committee on Natural Resources and Energy. And he was involved in that recent debate over how to classify renewable energy projects that changed how we think about Hydro-Québec in our portfolio. Tony Klein, nice to talk with you again.
Happy to be here.
So, you know, the scale of the projects in Quebec, for example, where Vermont gets a significant amount of its electric power generation, have been a conversation starter and a difficult one, and also the topic of legal debate when it comes to how we think of something as renewable. It wasn't included for a while, partly because of the size and scale. Now it is. Steve Crowley, where do you come in on that?
Well, you know, size limitations have always been a little bit arbitrary about this. You can have some substantial projects that are still, you know, pretty well defined as renewable. So there are some good projects in Vermont that are pretty big that fit into that renewable category because that limit was raised. But then when you look at what's happening up north, you have to start thinking about what the resource really is. And if it were just the rivers, well, you'd have to start thinking about the fact that it's releasing a lot of mercury into the rivers, and that's been working its way up the food chain and affecting communities, whether it's in native communities in some parts and other communities elsewhere. There's methyl mercury is a potent neurotoxin that's been harming people, making them sick. So that's one question that comes in. Never get permitted in Vermont. These things would not happen here. But the other thing is, when you think about the projects up there, first of all, the scale, we're talking about 10,000 square miles of land that have been flooded in northern Quebec. And that's the size of the state of Vermont. Vermont's portion is a little less than 1% of that. if you look at the terawatt hours that we import. So even that's 100 square miles. You know, imagine flooding 100 square miles of Vermont. It would just not happen. But what happens when you do that, especially in that landscape, is that the rivers form the core of the ecosystem of that landscape. You're talking about vast boreal forest, and the rivers are kind of the lifeblood of that ecosystem. So you think of the kind of animals that live there, and the fishers and the martens and the otters and the moose, and you know, and they depend on those rivers and riverbanks, and those are gone now. And now you're talking about an ecosystem that has been fundamentally altered. You know, I think of an analogy. You know, let's say you have this great little patch of milkweed out in your yard, and some filmmaker comes along and says, "I'd love to film those monarch butterflies, and it's such a great thing. And they come back every year, and I want to get that on film." They say, "Sure." You sign a contract, and the next thing you know, you have boom trucks and cameras and dozens of people coming in. And when they're gone, your yard is fundamentally changed. You still got the milkweed plant. You still got the monarch butterflies, and that keeps coming back. But the space is fundamentally altered. So,
if what we're talking about here is a fundamental shift in our climate, say, if we continue to use carbon-based resources, that if we think about what Paul Hines was saying, that everything comes with a cost, and it's weighing those costs and figuring out where it is we're trying to go and how we get there. You know, even if we say nobody would argue with you that the ecosystem has changed, could it still be a better change than the alternative?
Well, let's talk a little bit about carbon, because that is really important. And it's not really part of the renewable definition, but it's equally important. These projects are not carbon neutral by any means. When you strip out 10,000 square miles of boreal forest, you are, first of all, you're eliminating an enormous, what we call, carbon sink. That forest is sitting there absorbing carbon. The trees are growing. You had a great discussion on this on Thursday on Vermont Edition with some really good ideas about how that forest grows and builds carbon into the soil and into its biomass. So that's 10,000 square miles of lost carbon sink up there. So that's one part of the equation. And the other part, which is actually works out to be about an equal amount in the opposite direction, is that there are ongoing emissions. There is carbon dioxide, methane, carbon life forms built into the soil. And that is gradually now, it's been locked up in the soil. In that cold forest, it tends to lock up actually a lot more than here. It's a much, much more of a carbon-sinking kind of forest. And so once you flood that, you start to mobilize the carbon that's in the soil. And this takes time. It does gradually decrease, but the data shows that it decreases over a very long time. So over maybe 80 years, you lose half of it. So it's still generating. So in both counts, let me put this in comparison to other energy sources. If you burn natural gas, which is the cleanest of the if you just look at the carbon direct carbon emissions from natural gas, it's the cleanest of the fossil fuels. That puts out about 400 grams of carbon per kilowatt hour to get a common coal, double that. Fracked gas, and when you start thinking about the emissions from the gas fields and all, the methane emissions, you have to double that for natural gas. But Hydro-Quebec power comes in at roughly 200 grams, so maybe half of the carbon emissions, combining both the sink and the emissions.
So it's not without a carbon cut. It's not carbon neutral.
Carbon neutral, carbon free.
Tony Klein, I know you've been collecting your thoughts, but before we come to you, I want to go to Brian, who's calling in from Montreal and has some perspective on this as well. Brian, it's nice to talk with you.
Hi. I'm going to try to be less of a geek than I am in daily life, but I'm going to talk a little technicality here, so I hope you'll bear with me for a few minutes, maybe minutes. I was a junior estimator, just learning to be a civil engineer when the James Bay project, which is a project our science teacher has just finished describing very well to us, was in the conception stage. So I was the man sitting with a topographic map. We didn't have digital photography, digital mapping yet then, tracing with a pencil where the pond of water would be at its highest and where it would be at its lowest, and where we would get the rock and the mud and the clay from to make the dikes to fill in the little hollows between the hills. That's what I did for 4 years and conceived the project, which ended up being chosen by our government for Hydro-Quebec's biggest single electrical power source. I'm not going to dispute the science of what I just heard, but I want to make two small comments politically and technically. First, at the same time as this technical study was going on, we had a very dramatic political movement. The First Nations, as we call them here, were moving, and the James Bay Cree, who are the traditional users of that entire land, were demanding that their needs be taken into account, and they actually held up the project until our provincial and federal governments listened and negotiated with their high-powered lawyers. So if we're going to talk about justice, and that's an important issue, justice was a major issue for the Cree. Their long-term perspective is foremost in their minds, and they were the ones, after long years of fighting in the courts and fighting in the conference rooms, who decided this project was best for them. They took into account the best science knowledge about carbon emissions and carbon sinks, about their way of life and the best way their community can survive for centuries.
So, Brian, so that was one point, the social justice. And let me hurry you to the next point, just in the interests of time.
The second quick comment is, yes, I understand that mercury and carbon are disturbed dramatically by that monster project, but it's done. I'm sorry that has to be said, but it's done. And we are living with the consequences. And I don't think they're as dramatic as we've heard, but I won't dispute that right now. The point I want to make on a regional basis is that if we do start to think of this northeast of North America as a single electrical system, we make possible diverse sources of renewable energy. When the wind is blowing in northern Quebec and the Innu there, who are negotiating for the same deal for them, their wind may power when it isn't blowing in Vermont, or when it isn't blowing in Connecticut, or when it isn't blowing off Cape Cod. And the battery that our premier talked about is really important to make that system stable, because when and only when that wind isn't blowing, we can just automatically switch the power from James Bay. It doesn't have to be the predominant source, but it stabilizes the system and it makes possible what would be technically and humanly impossible otherwise. I hope I've made a small contribution, and I can talk more, but I want to let you talk too.
Well, Brian, I really appreciate your perspective, especially as somebody who worked on that James Bay project as a young engineer. And, you know, it's interesting that you bring us back out from Vermont and looking at this as a bigger picture and looking at this as a regional landscape and regional grid. And today we're asking the question, how green is Vermont's renewable energy and what makes it renewable or not renewable? We're discussing that definition and looking at the costs and benefits of different kinds of energy sources. And we've been focusing a little bit on Hydro-Quebec and hydropower and that specific hydro project, because it's not only a big part of Vermont's portfolio, but it can be kind of illustrative of some of the concerns and considerations that go into a conversation about energy sources and what we define and how we define them. We've heard from Steve Crowley, who's part of the Vermont chapter of the Sierra Club, and Paul Hines, who's a UVM electrical engineering professor. And former state rep Tony Klein has been very patient, waiting for his turn. He was the chair of the House Committee on Natural Resources and Energy. And Tony, you helped think about this definition of renewable. So bring us back to where you've been thinking about this entry point of yours in the conversation about renewable energy in Hydro-Quebec.
Well, I'm happy to do that, and patience is not one of my virtues.
I know, but you've been doing so well.
All the points have been well spoken to, and it's just a political determination. Renewable is renewable, but the factors that you want to put on it to kind of limit it or rein it in are political. And as been said previously, when we first designated hydro as renewable in this state, we limited it to dams of no bigger than 80 megawatts because that happened to be the biggest dam in the state of Vermont. And then I believe we raised it to 200 megawatts because we were contemplating buying the Connecticut River dams, and that's what their size. So it, those designations are arbitrary. And as been stated before, designation of renewable has nothing to do really with the impacts that the delivery system that delivers it may impact on our environment, and that is up. That's actually up to the people in the legislature. If they want to redefine these definitions, that's what they should do. Some people want to put the size limitations on wind towers, for example, as defining it as renewable. So that's something that is open going to the future. I would like to make the perspective of when we looked at this issue, and this is back in 2010, our utilities, where we were getting 50% of our power from Hydro-Québec, they were in negotiations to re-up long-term contracts. And the reality is that if we hadn't expanded our definition of hydro of what's renewable for hydro, we would not have gotten probably the favorable prices that we got from Hydro-Québec. So that was a big determining factor, and plus the fact that Vermont was the only state that was going to recognize this as renewable, it was going to have very little impact on reality, drove us to do that, as well as we did actually trade that for having Governor Douglas support our standard offer program, which was the program that really jump-started the construction of solar and wind in the state of Vermont.
Well, so in a way, being able to define the hydropower from Hydro-Québec as renewable, you know, in terms of political considerations, Tony, you think allowed for some of these smaller scale projects that are seen as not only renewable, but perhaps more green or beneficial in nature?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely that is what occurred. And back in 2010, as the caller from Quebec called in and said, these plants were already built. We were already buying the power from it for a long time. So any impact that they had was already in place. So to deny the opportunity to benefit from it didn't seem to make sense to us.
Paul Hines, we're thinking now about our sources differently. You know, we try to think about what is the impact, but we always have to have political considerations in place. We also have to have considerations about, you know, how much baseline power we need, and mm-hmm. can this source deliver on that? Can this be a source that we rely on? You know, we've heard mm-hmm. a couple comments about that. What's baseline power versus intermittent power? And, mm-hmm. you know, it does seem like we're always going to have to make some choices that we would perhaps prefer not to make, but it's, you know, it's the reality is there are choices, and there are people or animals or landscapes that are going to suffer no matter what, right?
Yeah, this is a really key challenge that the electricity industry all over the world is facing right now. And wind and solar are the two fastest growing sources of electricity worldwide, and they come and go with the wind and the sun. And electricity supply and demand have to match every instant of every day. And so what you end up having to do is come up with other ways to balance the ups and downs of the wind and the solar. Hydro does that pretty well in general, because you can, with most hydro plants, you can kind of adjust their output based on where the need is. You know, natural gas plants do that really well as well. You know, about half of the electricity in New England comes from natural gas outside of Vermont. And so, but we would like to get away from that. And so the question is, if we're not going to use hydro, how are we going to balance those resources? And there's lots of stuff going on. You know, people are working on batteries. We're working on ways to make loads more flexible. But it's hard, and it's really hard work. And I think that if we're not going to use hydro, we need to come up with other ways to make the system flexible.
We have a note from Jane on VPR.net, our website, who says it does come down to definitions and how far one can stretch a meaning of a term like renewable energy. Robert in Burlington says, today the urge to zero carbon seems to trump all other renewability questions, and is wondering, you know, what other goals we should have besides non-carbon in our renewability goals. And let's go to Tim, who's calling in from Barnard. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
And thanks for my call, Jane. Couple points. I'm in the forest products industry. I call every once in a while when these topics come up. And I wanted to make a couple quick bullet points and then a comment for your guest at the Sierra Club to answer maybe off air. So the bullet points are all the above renewable resources are a good thing. I'm not against it. But they should be put in perspective of if we're taking natural gas from outside the state and region and bringing it into our Vermont region, New Hampshire region to put in the power grid, and it creates one job on the outside, but it kills a job factor here in the forest products industry. In particular, I'm in biomass industry, Burlington McNeil Station and Radgate Power Plant, and it's billions of dollars our industry puts into the economy. That's getting killed. Wanted to make the next point in regards to solar. I really think the agricultural impact that this is having is we've just begun to scratch the surface of the negative point of view, excuse me. And it really, we're taking our landscape away. Now, logging, this is the point I want to make to the Sierra Club guest. Sorry, I just don't know his name. I forgot that. But in regards to forest products, when we clear cut, for instance, in an area that warrants a clear cut, that's not deforestation. That's restarting it just like you plant a crop. And it is a good thing. And the wildlife thrives at all different levels of a forest and sustainable forest. And our industry has to be protected. And I would like you all to remember, and all your guests outside, is that forest products and agriculture are the original industries in Vermont. And we should protect that heritage.
Tim, I hear you. And I want to put that question then to Steve Crowley, who's with us, who's part of the Vermont chapter of the Sierra Club and has also been an environmental advocate and a science teacher. So, Steve, you know, what about this question of biomass? And you can expand it a little bit as well from what Tim's talking about.
Yeah, biomass is a tricky one. It's full of depends. It depends on how much you're harvesting in a certain area. It depends on what kind of the forest varies so much. Forest practices vary so much. Are you clear cutting an area to provide biomass? Are you taking the waste wood? Are you leaving enough there to allow the forest nutrient cycle to continue? There's a whole lot of questions about biomass. And then there's questions about how it's used. You know, is it used just to produce electricity, which is very wasteful? You know, 25% of the power that's in the wood gets turned into electricity. 75% is waste. So, but are you combining it with heat, advanced wood heat? There are a lot of different ways. So it's on both sides, both the where you get the wood and how you use it. And remember that Vermont's forest has lots of uses. So, again, there's this question of are you looking at the river alone for its renewability? Are you looking at the landscape? Are you looking at the ecosystem that it's a part of? So Vermont's forests especially have a huge set of different kinds of uses and demands.
So, Steve, when you are, at your kitchen table and using the napkin to figure out what you think the portfolio should be, and there are all of these considerations. And again, we haven't talked so much today about reduction and the reduction in energy uses, which are, of course, a huge part of this whole conversation. And really, we can't have this conversation without talking about it. But since we're talking about the sources themselves, that's where we're focusing today. But so, what would your portfolio be?
Well, I want to emphasize something that Tim said when he started off. He pointed out about when we bring in fossil fuels from elsewhere, and likewise when we bring in power from Hydro-Québec, or when we buy the renewable energy credits, which is more complicated, which are completely useless from Hydro-Québec, that is, because they don't add anything. There's no incentive for anything. But when we pull power in from elsewhere, we are shortcutting the Vermont renewable energy economy that is poised to grow. And it has been growing. It's been under threat in the last couple of years. But we have a tremendous opportunity to produce local power, whether it's at tiny scale, medium scale, even moderately large scale. But we can do this. And there are plenty of opportunities. There's small-scale hydro that people are working on, you know, low-impact, small-scale hydro that people are working on. There's some good biomass projects that are happening. There's a lot of great solar, but you know, and wind. You know, our Vermont Sierra Club does support the development of wind power, but properly sited wind power. So, you know, we don't make a general statement about that. But, you know, there are just so many different possibilities, and the potential for Vermont's renewable energy economy is fantastic. And I would include, as you point out, the energy efficiency aspect of that.
Well, so it sounds like for Steve, a lot of it is local generation, small-scale generation. Tony Klein, I mean, you've looked at this from a legislative perspective. You spent a lot of time on it. Where do you think we're going?
Well, let me first say that's been stated before that on the electric side of things, Vermont's done a pretty darn good job. And our problem is in the transportation and the heating sectors. And that's where we should be having the discussions. All the stuff that we're talking about now is minutia as far as I'm concerned. But you're not going to meet the energy demands through total small-scale renewable in this state. That's just not going to happen. It's good. It's good for the economy. I approve of it. I support it. But to just say that that's going to be a dependable source that's affordable is just not right. So you have to combine a lot of things. And fortunately or unfortunately, that resource up in Hydro-Québec exists and will exist, and it is at a good price. And Vermont has done very well by it. I will put one hesitation on it, and I'll remind folks of the ice storm in the late 90s. To my knowledge, there's still only one entry point for Hydro-Québec coming into Vermont, and that went down, and it went down for 6 to 8 weeks, and that caused some of our utilities to almost go bankrupt because they had to get power off of the high-priced power market.
So as pointed out, you know, every single source has potential downsides and upsides. Paul Hines, we're not going to get to give you the last word here, but I appreciate all three of you helping to have this conversation because it's so instructive to think about the sources and how everybody has different considerations of what they weigh as the most important things. Paul Hines is an associate professor of electrical engineering at UVM, and he started the startup Packetized Energy. Steve Crowley is an environmental advocate with the Vermont chapter of the Sierra Club. And Tony Klein is a former representative and past chair of the House Committee on Natural Resources and Energy. Thanks very much to all three of you.
Thank you.
Thanks. It was great to be here.